You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet, always here in my individual capacity. We're returning to our series on scaling AI. Now, if our economy is the foundation of our national security, should we be worried about an AI bust in the market, one that might leave American taxpayers holding the bag and lead to predatory foreign investment or worse? Sarah Myers-West and Amba Kak of AI Now Institute think we should interrogate the current weight of investment and market dependence on AI and demand concrete data behind some of these AI companies' claims. They're singing our tune, so I thought, let's talk to Sarah tonight. Sarah, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
All right, let's set the stage. There are going to be a lot of people listening to this. They hear AI, but you know, maybe they don't know what our concerns are. But it appears right now, and there certainly is a lot of data to support this, that six large companies, Oracle, Microsoft, OpenAI, AMD, and XAI, and NVIDIA, they're moving money between each other instead of actually delivering profits to shareholders and investors. And I wonder, what are you seeing? What makes you nervous if it does?
Yeah. So what we're seeing is a small group of AI companies all sort of arrive on the same conclusion, which is we need to build out massive amounts of data center infrastructures for the future of AI development. Now, they have nowhere near the revenue figures to support this kind of build out. We're seeing this collective hallucination about the need for scale at all cost. And what they've arrived on in order to finance these infrastructures is a series of circular deals. So, for example, NVIDIA, which is the company that makes graphical processing units, these are the chips that are used to power AI systems housed in these data centers, has a ton of cash on the books. And so they've made this circular arrangement with OpenAI, where OpenAI is going to build out data centers, purchasing NVIDIA chips, but gets a big check every time it brings, you know, a gigawatt of that data center infrastructure online, written by none other than NVIDIA. So it looks like you have the movement of massive amounts of money, but it's not really delivering any sort of net economic benefit. And it's all hinged on projected future growth that's at the moment nowhere really on the horizon.
So NVIDIA is it was $4.5 trillion company as of October. It slipped a little bit, we have to say. So they agreed to invest up to $100 billion in OpenAI, and OpenAI said, okay, and then we agree to buy your chips. And so that's kind of how it went. Then OpenAI said, oh, you know what? We will agree to deploy 6 gigawatts of AMD GPUs, these graphic processing units you mentioned. And AMD said, well, okay, OpenAI, we'll give you the option to buy up to 60 million shares. That's a lot of shares. Similarly, Oracle, which slipped again since this time, they spent tens of millions of dollars on NVIDIA chips. And they also got OpenAI a deal for $300 billion with a cloud deal with Oracle. So it's kind of like just a big circle with a bunch of little circles on it. NVIDIA may be in the middle, and the money's just moving between them. And I haven't mentioned, you know, XAI or Microsoft and Intel, but they're in this too. And the money is just shifting back and forth. And we will put in the notes to the cast a graphic that depicts this. But there have been moments when, you sort of alluded to this already, when C-suite level officers in these companies say things. And one of the things that I liked about the piece you penned in Wall Street Journal was that sometimes they slip and they reveal that they think the government is somehow going to function as their guarantor. Can you talk about what happened in October and how this C-suite level person walked back this claim?
It's so funny that this ended up being described publicly as a slip, because OpenAI had already published letters to the White House expressly calling for sort of federal guarantees for loans to the company. And they'd said this multiple times over and referenced it in previous reports. And frankly, the White House itself, in its executive order on the data center build out, had charged the Office of Science and Technology Policy with looking into what ways the White House can go about providing the financial backing for AI infrastructure. So what we argue is this isn't just, you know, a possible future bailout. It's a bailout that's really already happening in the many ways that the government has already stepped in to backstop this industry. And I think what's important to note here is, you know, it's one thing when investors decide to make risky bets on technology. It's a very different thing when governments step in and place those kinds of bets. And from what we're seeing, the investors are somewhat skittish about this technology, but we're not seeing that kind of intentionality behind the government policymaking around this industry that's really stepping in to backstop it.
Well, I mean, as of this moment, it feels like the policy here is just sort of let them run with it. And it's interesting that it's happening because I think there's not even a consensus right now on what general artificial intelligence is, if that is indeed the goal beyond these large language models, which in my estimation, oftentimes are just kind of bad Google searches interlaced with maybe a little Grammarly and spell check, with a lot of hallucinations and not great information and based on spurious data.
I think that's totally right. And we're not just talking about, you know, an industry needing to prove its utility, and maybe it will down the line. It needs to prove its utility to the tune of what consultants at Bain & Company estimated to be $2 trillion in annual AI revenue by 2030 to justify the amount of spending that's going into the infrastructure. Some reporters at the Wall Street Journal did the math and found that's more than the combined 2024 revenue of Amazon, Apple, Alphabet, Microsoft, Meta, and Nvidia together. It's more than five times the size of the entire global subscription software market, those journalists reported. And so we're talking about unprecedented amounts of revenue for the tech sector and way in a different league than what they've demonstrated themselves to be capable of right now.
Well, I mean, at least from my perspective, a lot of this seems to be competition between a lot of powerful men that seem to be trying to one-up each other, and they say so publicly. And there are a lot of these things that make me really wonder if the goal is in competition among some very successful individuals, as opposed to sort of any benefit to the American public or the global well-being of humanity. I just haven't seen it yet. But how do cloud companies factor into this?
So they're really important because in many ways, the reason why we've sort of arrived where we're at right now is because of the role of the cloud firms, your Google, Microsoft, Amazon. These are the companies that dominated the field of AI research over the last decade and a half. You know, you see this shift happening starting around 2012, where everybody starts to go all in on deep learning, where you start to see the rise of the corporate AI labs and taking over prominence at the leading AI research conferences, and sort of focusing in on this one version of building AI. And it's conveniently the version that plays perfectly to their incentive structures. This version of AI, which is not the only way of approaching this technology, relies on massive amounts of data, which they have, huge sort of cloud infrastructures, which they sell. And the path to market is at present only routes through the enterprise software ecosystems that they have control over. So I think you're totally right that this is in many ways a market that's being shaped by an arms race, not between countries trying to, you know, pursue AI dominance, but between a few billionaires that are trying to protect their positions. And we've seen this, you know, said pretty explicitly by Sundar Pichai, by Mark Zuckerberg, saying that the cost of not going all in on this technology is going to be far worse than the cost of, you know, not investing, even though they have no idea what it's going to be useful for just yet.
Yeah, but people react to fear. So couching it in fearful terms is kind of an interesting approach, particularly since at least Peter Thiel was caught saying, I don't know if this was hot mic, I don't know if this is apocryphal, but something along the lines of using technology to control sort of the voting public and how they think about certain issues because he couldn't persuade them. So I just find that very interesting. How much did Amazon, Alphabet, Apple, Meta, Microsoft, and Nvidia make in 2024?
So a bunch of reporters at the Wall Street Journal looked into this, and they found that the combined revenue all of the companies that you just mentioned exceeds the amount of AI revenue that the entire AI market needs to make by 2020, 30 every single year. So for OpenAI to reach profitability, it's going to take about $2 trillion in annual AI revenue, according to Bain & Company. And that would require revenues that are more than, six of the Magnificent Seven companies.
Have you thought about what is in it for these companies? They think maybe they won't have to hire people. Maybe it'll be more out of, there'll be some cost savings. I mean, I wonder if there's any data on this. And I wonder if this is just a fat lot of nonsense at the end of the day or just sort of speculative.
I think it's really worth thinking through what's the end goal here. So set aside whether the bubble's going to burst. If there's no bubble, if this market is wildly successful, what is the world that we're living in? And the vision that's been painted for us is one really of mass job displacement. It's necessarily a world that has increased levels of surveillance because you need to have the data to power these tools to make things like AI agents function. And ironically, it's also a world of greater top-down control, where you have, a select few companies and corporate leaders who have very close ties to political leaders that are sort of running the market. And we've placed kind of all of our bets on this one technology working out at a time that our broader research infrastructure, the NIH, the NSF, our universities are getting defunded. So we've kind of shortchanged the future of our innovation ecosystem for the sake of this one technology. And it's a technology that consolidates power, doesn't really provide widespread benefits to the public so much as it helps out a select number of firms to deepen their power and controlling to get tremendously rich.
Well, on that score, what do consumer surveys show about the promise of AI in business?
I'm not going to be the one to say that this technology is never going to be useful, that it isn't, worth playing around with. There's like obvious utility to these tools. But what we're seeing from the business sector is that for a variety of reasons, the enterprise use of these tools has not really taken off in the way that was hoped. And that's for a few different reasons. One is that there are and remain tremendous cybersecurity vulnerabilities within these systems. Many of these may not be remediable. Things like being able to exfiltrate data from prompts, being able to use prompt engineering to get the system to behave in ways that sort of circumvent guardrails that have implemented into them. It's pretty reasonably easy to be able to integrate poison pills in training data sets that can then be activated down the line. There's just a whole lot of ways that you can mess around with these systems and get them to behave in ways that enterprise firms wouldn't want you to be able to. And secondly, for a lot of the use cases that people want to be able to use AI for, you need to be able to tell factual information from non-factual information. That's what lets you delegate, right? That's what lets you use it as a research tool or an information gathering tool. But because of this really baked-in propensity for hallucination, which is AI systems kind of confidently making up information that's not true when asked for, factual information, it just makes them not very useful for a number of tasks. Some places people are still, experimenting even despite these factors. But I think we're going to start seeing around us the many ways that these systems are failing in ways that are going to give us all a tremendous amount of pause.
You said something I thought was interesting, cybersecurity concerns, and we're going to have multiple podcasts in our series on that. I've had pre-calls with several people who are experts in this field that say that, there's no such thing as red team efficacy. To your point, these things cannot be remediated, that, you can't flatten certain things in order to peruse them for flaws. The other thing is, in listening to you and one of the conversations I've already had, there is great concern about intellectual property, trade secrets, corporate securities information, and also the possibility that these models could establish themselves in a way that would allow that to be a feeding cycle. In other words, you take this on, you're an enterprise purchaser of one of these tools, you implement it, and it turns out that tool is harvesting whatever you have in order to feed its model, and it becomes really unreliable. So I just wonder if any of these sort of investment groups or people who are running these companies, what they really think about this stuff, because they've all signed different agreements about what they can and cannot say publicly, particularly even after they leave, even if they're fired.
Yeah, if anything, we've seen significant increases in opacity around these systems over time. The commercial AI labs once were a place where you were seeing a huge amount of publicly published research coming out, where, you know, yeah, they were sort of setting the horizon for the state of the technology in the work that they were publishing out. And we've received less and less information over time about what data they're training on and so on and so forth. One of the use cases that my research institute, the AI Now Institute, recently published out about, our chief scientist, Heidi Clough, and one of our senior fellows, Sophia Guerra, were looking at some of the use cases emerging around AI and nuclear energy. And, you know, it takes a long time to bring a nuclear power plant online. It takes a long time to validate the safety engineering of these plants. And so some people have proposed using large language models to speed up the permitting process, ingesting text, being able to produce the paperwork faster, setting aside that the process in some ways is what enables you to make things safe, like it's slow for a reason, friction exists for a reason. What would necessarily be true for this to work, you're feeding into, you know, an inherently insecure large language model, deeply sensitive information about nuclear engineering, which we have a number of international agreements to try and protect this information, and a significant propensity for giving that information out accidentally. So I think you really have a perfect storm in some of the use cases that are emerging for real and pressing national security vulnerabilities that are emerging within these systems just by the kinds of use cases that are being put forward for them.
So what do you think? Will the government bail these companies out?
I mean, like I said, I think that they already are. I think, you know, across a number of different fronts, from the very significant push to deregulate, we've seen test balloons floated around reviving the moratorium on states' abilities to enforce their laws on AI in the proposed leaked executive order that ended up not being introduced at the end of the day. But certainly a lot of interest flagged by the executive in trying to deregulate the industry. We have an executive order on export AI, which is focused on how to create markets. It was reported out in the New York Times about how the White House AI czar David Sacks has gone out and tried to strike deals on behalf of companies like NVIDIA with other nation states to try and sell AI systems abroad. And also, you know, this sort of unrolling the red carpet for the build out of energy infrastructure, allocating federal lands for building out data centers. I think what's notable here is that what we're seeing is really different in nature from what we've seen from other industries that have been deemed of national and economic security importance over time. You know, this is not the semiconductor industry where the government had already invested in the foundational research that helped the industry to emerge in the first place, where there were already very clear and proven use cases for chips before the government came in with its policy measures to backstop the industry, and where the government was really getting a lot in return. Like here, it's all of these handouts, but really in ways that are kind of giving up leverage over the industry and getting very little back. So it feels a lot more like really a kind of patronage network or crony capitalism than it does, you know, the kind of industrial policy that is ultimately going to set up the nation for success. Certainly not if it's being done at the cost of the American public.
Yeah, the leaked executive order, that was interesting. So it probably was more efficient, I guess, to leak it than, you know, the regular notice and comment period publication in the Federal Register. Let's just see what we find on social media. So, but this didn't start, this sort of focus on AI is not exclusive to the Trump administration, even though maybe it's on steroids right now. But we saw this in the prior administration too, isn't that right?
That's right. We already saw a lot of these moves begin under the Biden administration with executive orders. Like the national security memo, I think, was one example of this, where you saw Jake Sullivan go before the National Defense University and say, you know, really, we need to be a better customer for the industry. And I think, you know, already there was a real investment in trying to build out industrial policy that would boost the AI industry and treat it of particular strategic importance. I think the real distinction there is that with the Biden administration, there were also a number of guardrails that were introduced to ensure that there were stronger protections for the public, that there were reasonable safety guardrails, mandates that, you know, companies be compliant with existing law. And I think we're seeing much less of that today.
A lot of it is about narrative and sort of the spin, right? And treating AI or referring to it like a moonshot or space race has been something of a misleading narrative. I mean, is there a single identifiable accomplishment with respect to AI technology that, if attained, could indicate global primacy in some sort of imagined AI race?
Rather than thinking about particular capabilities or measuring AI models against benchmarks, what we should really be talking about is, how is this technology delivering for the American people? Is it meaningfully making people's lives better and not worse? So if there were any kind of accomplishment to evaluate this against, what is it doing for the public at large? Is it leading to a race to the top? But I think right now we're kind of stuck in a race to the bottom, and the public is really bearing a lot of the cost.
Let's talk about that executive order. There was an executive order that was out there, and basically it looked like it was sort of a get out of jail free card. It was sort of the, I guess, an analog to something like Communications Decency Act, Section 230, that basically immunized social media companies against lawsuits. Did you take a look at that? What are your thoughts? And I'm asking you to sort of read the tea leaves here. Is this thing going to get pumped out at some point? And if so, why?
So as you mentioned, the executive order would have been designed to basically exempt AI companies from scrutiny at the state level and to try and push for a federal preemption of any regulatory framework. It ultimately did not get entered, I think, after it was clear that there was a fair amount of disagreement with this kind of measure. You know, reminder that the proposal that went through Congress to introduce this kind of moratorium was voted down on bipartisan lines 99-1 and didn't move forward this summer. What we've seen instead is a sort of grab bag of different kinds of alternative measures be introduced. So there's a sandbox act that would help companies avert scrutiny if they comply with some levels of engaging in like regulatory experimentation. There's another proposal that was introduced over the summer called the RISE Act that would remove AI developers from liability for the outcomes of their products if they produce safety cards that, you know, essentially disclose the kinds of harms that their systems might produce. There's a handful of other kinds of measures that roughly do similar things to the moratorium that are up in the air. Whether any one of these things is going to go through is very unclear. I think what is clear is that there is a tremendous amount of interest coming from the industry in seeing these things through, and a tremendous amount of reticence from the broader public being channeled through regulators that they absolutely do not want to see this industry go unscrutinized.
Apparently, some of the AI companies were seeking privilege over chat, something akin to, you know, for our listeners, like attorney-client privilege. You'd have to pierce the privilege in order to acquire it. And what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, this is something that Sam Altman has referenced in a few interviews lately that he'd especially like to see, essentially granting privilege over the communications that, as I understand it, individual users have with their AI systems. And this comes on the heels of, you know, a number of reported instances of tremendous mental health harms that are happening alongside the interactions of individuals with these systems, where, you know, they're being prompted in their communications to engage in self-harm. where there's been reports of like sort of exacerbated psychosis that's coming from the engagement that people are having with systems that have been calibrated purposefully to be sycophantic, that are meant to please, that are meant to encourage, and where the guardrails are clearly falling down. So I think it's deeply concerning that, you know, there would be proposals for those kinds of interactions to be privileged in a way that would not let enforcers then be able to look under the hood and understand what's happened in these interactions when they've led to really severe consequences for their users.
So let's talk for a second. This push to integrate AI into the federal government and the Defense Department. Let's imagine that, you know, there are people outside the Beltway who don't understand what a cash cow this is. Can you talk a little bit about how this is, you're really hitting pay dirt if you can pull this one off?
Yeah. So the thing that, you know, as we started at the top of our conversation, the thing that these companies need the most is stable, lucrative, long-term contracts. They need significant sources of revenue, and there is very few more lucrative and long-term sources of revenue that you can get out there than being able to strike deals with the defense agencies and with the federal government. And I think for that reason, we've seen, you know, a very big push, the launch of different initiatives from these companies to make themselves available for government contracting, in many respects to rebrand themselves as defense contractors after, you know, a number of years of being very hesitant to engage with defense agencies, in many ways sell their commercial tools really off the shelf for integration in often very highly sensitive and secure contexts.
You know, there have been some recent documented failures of AI systems incorporated in and weaponry used by the Defense Department that they just did not function at all as described. So hopefully that won't just result in some sort of a lifting of standards to the point where there are things that, you know, make our armed forces less safe and the American public less safe. Is American AI on a mission to sell its products overseas? And what has Jensen Huang, the CEO of NVIDIA, been doing lately? He must be aloft, more or less ongoing, right?
I mean, he's had his sovereign AI presentation that he's been shopping around for about a year and change now to different governments all around the world. Yes, I think very much there is a pursuit of the sale of AI products anywhere that they're going to be bought, especially trying to sell to other government agencies around the world. You could feel this really palpably at the AI summit that was held in Paris about 10 months ago, where, you know, ostensibly this was a summit that was focused on public interest AI and ensuring that AI is going to serve the needs of the broader public. But it became as much about different government agencies getting as close as they could to AI companies and to try and strike deals. So I think very much so there is a mission to try and sell these products overseas. It is likewise a mission right now of the executive as outlined in the Export AI executive order. And I think it's rightfully so causing real questions from governments around the world, especially in the majority world, who are understandably hesitant to deepen dependencies on, you know, products that are produced by a handful of U.S. firms.
Talk to our listeners a bit about what we should be thinking about and questioning going forward when it comes to AI, the impact on the economy and potential national security concerns in your view.
Yeah, so there's a few things that I would really put front and center. There's a huge amount of conversation right now happening about, is there an AI bubble or not? What's going to happen if the bubble bursts? And I think that those are good questions to be asking, but not the only questions to be asking. I think it's equally important to be thinking about what happens if there is no bursting to the bubble, if we see the perpetuation of some of the dynamics that we've seen in this industry that, you know, seem really unhealthy for the public at large. I think that we're poised to see deepen concentration through these kinds of circular deals, which act as a kind of vertical integration between a few firms that are poised to be the winners in the market, that this is being reinforced by public policy decisions that are essentially serving to pick winners and losers, and that are creating a very close nexus between the leaders of a few very well capitalized companies and a government that's, you know, not disinterested from those interests. So that's one. I think the other thing that we need to be talking about when we're talking about AI is not so much about progress against any one or another benchmark, but really we need to be talking about power. How is AI being used in ways that impact the public? And really pressingly, how is it being used in ways that are deepening and entrenching inequality, contributing to greater insecurity than to security, and where the end vision really doesn't put the needs of the public at the center? If anything, it seems likely to harm the public. That's likely to lead to greater geopolitical instability, economic instability. We need to be taking a long and hard look at the end goal here and what kinds of institutional structures we need to protect the public in light of that. So I think that there are very real concerns for small d democracy that emanate from the trajectory that we're on right now. But there's nothing about it that's inevitable. There's still a lot of scope for, you know, smart policymaking, smart enforcement that puts us on another path. That's what I think we need to be really thinking about as we look forward to what's to come in this sector.
I heard an optimistic note there at the end.
Yeah, no, I do feel like there's reason for optimism, because there's like nothing about this needs to be in front of us. There is a lot of scope for change.
Well, it's been fun talking to you tonight, Sarah. And you can find more from Sarah West and the AI Now Institute, and we'll give you their website, which is ainowinstitute.org. We will hyperlink to an op-ed Sarah and her colleague wrote in the Wall Street Journal in the notes to the cast. Thanks for coming in, and we look forward to talking to you again in the future as this whole thing develops.
Thank you so much for having me, Elisa. I appreciate it.
All right. And thank you for listening to NSLT. Be sure to subscribe to NSLT on Apple, Spotify, or Amazon, whichever one you want. Like and share this episode with a friend, not because we're obnoxious, because that's how we trigger this algorithm. Nothing else we can do about it. We had a conference, as you know, and some of you might not have been able to go, but even if you did go, you may want to listen to a panel on AI. It's the AI Arms Race and National Security Law. We're going to go ahead and post a link to that in the notes. And the person who moderated that was Margaret Hugh. You may know her to be the author, probably the first legal textbook on artificial intelligence. All right. Our unity is a key feature of our national security. And when we can't agree, we can agree to listen to one another and have thoughtful conversations. So part of that is having difficult conversations, too, about trends informing things as complex as the economy and as mood-based as the zeitgeist. Things like the rapid expansion of AI without guardrails. So we remain fortunate to live in a country with greater diversity of thought than probably any other, and that's a good thing as long as we remain willing to engage in critical thinking. Thanks for listening tonight. The writer, producer, and host of this cast is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is Francis Burkham. My other co-producer is the Never Stops, Holly McMahon. Our program manager is Antasia Hawkins-Blakeney. Social media and research support comes from Alana Coopersmith. And we are forever grateful to the brilliant minds of the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, who perceive the good in the interest of national security without regard for politics or party. See you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.